justice and equality. It is not integration that most Negroes in America want. It is human dignity. It is human dignity.
You're listening to Manning Marable, By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What accounts for Malcolm X's meteoric rise in popularity among millions of African-American people, most of whom were not members of the Nation of Islam, most of whom did not hear him preach in the temples of the nation, but rather heard him in other venues outside of the dynamics of his religious organization? What accounts for his attractiveness? First, it is difficult for historians, it is difficult for me and us today, to capture the vibrant essence of Malcolm X, his earthy and human character, his position as a revolutionary teacher for a whole generation of young black militants, his total love for the dispossessed. Part of this greatness that he assumes as a social figure in history is derived from his own oppressed, sordid, personal evolution. It is, in effect, an example of the worst of us becoming the best of us. What accounts for his influence? His rhetoric, more than Martin Luther King Jr.'s, was almost hypnotic among black audiences. As the chief spokesman for the Nation of Islam, Malcolm preached a militant message which changed and challenged the lives of millions of poor and oppressed African American people. In a typical sermon, Malcolm might speak words such as these, and I'll quote from one of his speeches. "My beautiful black brothers and sisters, look at your skins. We're all black to the white man, but we're 1,001 different colors. Turn around, look at each other. During slavery, it was rare one of our black grandmothers who escaped the white rapist slave master. That rapist slave master who emasculated the black man with threats, with fear, until even today the black man lives with fear of the white man in his heart. Think of it. Think of the black slave man filled with fear and dread, hearing the screams of his wife, his mother, his daughter being taken in the barn, in the kitchen, in the bushes, and you were too filled with fear of the rapist to do anything about it. Every white man in America, when he looks into the black man's eyes, should fall on his knees and say, 'I'm sorry, I'm sorry. My kind has committed history's greatest crime against your kind. Will you give me a chance to atone?' But do you, brothers and sisters, expect the white man to do that? No, you do not. You know better. Every time you see this person, think about what you are seeing. Think about how it was on your slave foremothers and foreparents' bloody, sweaty backs that he built this empire that's today the richest of the nations on the earth, where his evil and his greed cause him to be hated around the world." Malcolm X would speak this way hundreds and hundreds of times to small groups and to large groups, in the cities and in the rural areas. He would speak for hours on end, working with people, talking with people, talking to individual families and to children. Malcolm said he would become so choked up after the hours of work every day that, quote, "sometimes I would walk in the streets until late into the night. I would speak to no one for hours, thinking to myself about what terrible things that had been done to our people here in the United States." Malcolm's evolution accelerates by 62 and 63 for several reasons. First, by 1962, Malcolm's personal prominence begins to create tensions and organizational rivalries inside of the Nation of Islam. Malcolm began to speak out less on religious issues and increasingly started to assert himself on contemporary political issues. We've tracked his speeches very carefully, and it is very true that there is a shift in the speeches he gives and in the content of his analysis between 60 to 63. The Islamic newspaper he had founded, Muhammad Speaks, was ordered to print less and less about Malcolm. We have charted this too. In 1962, there are virtually no articles published on Malcolm X. By 63, nothing. He is the main spokesperson of this organization. And the Nation of Islam's newspaper carries virtually not a word about him. This is well before he leaves the Nation. So clearly something is occurring inside of the organization. Muhammad's tight authoritarianism prohibited Malcolm and other more activist oriented ministers from becoming more involved in African American political struggles. Finally, two events forced Malcolm to make a fundamental question, a decision about his relationship with the Nation of Islam. On July the 3rd, 1963, two former secretaries of Elijah Muhammad filed paternity suits against him, claiming that the 67-year-old patriarch had fathered their four children. Any other Muslim member of the Nation of Islam would have been promptly expelled for the crime of adultery. Yet Muhammad maintained his high post, even after admitting to Malcolm personally and to other members and leaders of the Nation that the charges were true. Malcolm interviewed the two women. He learned that Muhammad had described him privately as, quote, a dangerous threat to his own position. And it cut Malcolm in the heart like a knife. When President Kennedy was assassinated, Malcolm commented to the press that his death was a case of, quote, the chickens coming home to roost, that the hate in white men had not stopped with the killing of defenseless black people, but that hate allowed to spread unchecked had finally struck down this country's chief of state, unquote. If one takes the whole quote in context, it makes a heck of a lot of sense. The chickens had come home to roost. Yet, the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad used this statement, which was only common sense, as a pretext for neutralizing their chief spokesperson. Malcolm was ordered into silence for 90 days, not allowed to teach in his own mosque, nor speak with the media. Returning to New York from his meeting with Elijah Muhammad in Chicago, Malcolm X was shattered to discover that the word had been given on the street to several Muslims to assassinate him. By March 1964, it was apparent that the Nation of Islam, after the period of 90 days of waiting, had no desire to reinstate Malcolm X under any conditions of submission. So Malcolm made a basic decision. He left the Nation of Islam. He announced first the creation of a new organization on March the 8th, 1964, Muslim Mosque Incorporated. Malcolm informed the press that he was now prepared to concentrate in local civil rights actions in the South and, quote, and elsewhere, and shall do so because every campaign for specific objectives can only heighten the political consciousness of the Negroes and intensify their identification against white society, unquote. Malcolm had less than 1 year to live, but during this year, he lived at least 20 years. Malcolm was attempting to develop a revolutionary perspective rooted in the tradition of black nationalism. Malcolm was attempting to build upon a political tradition that was a critique of racism, but that would go further in understanding the relationship between race and class oppression in the United States. Malcolm put it this way in his discussions with Alex Haley. He said, quote, I was trying to turn a corner into a new regard by the public, especially Negroes. I was no less angry than I had been, but at the same time, the true brotherhood he had seen in his 1964 journey to the Mideast and Africa had, quote, influenced me to recognize that anger can blind human vision, unquote. After his Hajj to Mecca, Malcolm was renamed El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, and Malcolm adopted Sunni Islam as his personal faith. But he carefully, unlike the Nation of Islam, carefully separated his personal faith from his political work in which he was engaged. This is another sign of change in his development. In the summer of 1964, Malcolm took the next step of development. He created an organization called the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the OAAU, a militant black nationalist organization based primarily in New York. During these years, Malcolm restructured many of his older ideas into a clearly uncompromising program which was both anti-racist and anti-capitalist. Like W.E.B. Du Bois before him, Malcolm and the OAAU planned to submit a list of human rights violations and acts of genocide against the United States. In other words, they said, the question of fighting against racism is not one of simply appealing to those who have acted in a criminal way against you in their courts of law. You take, as Malcolm put it, you take the criminal to court. You use the United Nations as the forum to raise questions of human rights inside of the United States. Malcolm broke with the logic of political reformism. He criticized African Americans for endorsing Lyndon Johnson's 1964 presidential candidacy. He predicted with grim accuracy that the Johnson administration would stop far short of providing a meaningful economic and social program which would benefit the masses of African American people. Criticizing the Negro middle class's commitment to private enterprise, Malcolm also had learned in his trip to Africa that black revolutionaries abroad had broken with their commitment to corporate capitalism and defined the economics of liberation with the term socialism. Malcolm said this, quote, you can't have racism without capitalism. And if you find anti-racists, usually they're socialists or their political philosophy is that of socialism, unquote. The OAAU developed a program that would build the resistance movement in the United States. The election of independent black candidates to public office, voter registration drives, promoting rent strikes to create better housing conditions for African Americans, the building of all black community schools, the creation of cultural centers, the initiation of black committees for community and neighborhood self-defense against racist attacks. By early 1965, Malcolm began to realize that his older messianic vision of an inevitable race war was also incorrect. Listen carefully the way he argued this. Malcolm insisted that America, quote, is the first country that may actually have a bloodless revolution. What would depend upon a bloodless revolution? It depended, Malcolm argued, upon the ability of African American people to develop a strategy of fundamental economic and political and social change and to act in concert with other elements of the oppressed in this country. Malcolm began to see that there was a linkage between racial oppression and class exploitation, which was fundamental. Malcolm began to attract supporters from all across the civil rights movement. People in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, people in the organization called the Congress of Racial Equality, people even inside of the NAACP began to attend Malcolm X speeches. Malcolm traveled south to work with the members of SNCC in Selma, Alabama. Malcolm spoke at Tuskegee Institute. He began to become a voice for the most progressive African Americans involved in the freedom struggle throughout the United States. Most black nationalists today who look back at Malcolm X with pride see the legacy of Malcolm, but must not make the mistake we have made around Martin Luther King Jr. We must assume the mantle of Malcolm X by understanding his evolution over time and seeing how his wisdom and his insight into the problem of racial inequality in this country became far more specific, clearer, and much more analytical by the end of his life. The best way that we can document this development is through one single speech. It was in Selma, Alabama, only weeks before Malcolm was killed, that he gave perhaps his greatest address. Malcolm gives his "I Am a Field Negro" speech, his most effective presentation of the class contradictions within the African-American community and the necessity for the masses of African-American people to recognize the necessity for uncompromising radical struggle. Here Malcolm X observed critically, quote, "There were, in black history, two kinds of Negroes. There was the old house Negro and the old field Negro. And the house Negro always looked out for his master. When the field Negroes got too much out of line, he held them back in check. He put them back on the plantation. If the master got hurt, he'd say, 'What's the matter, boss? We sick?' However, there were the field Negroes who lived in the huts, who had nothing to lose. They wore the worst kind of clothes. They ate the worst food. They caught hell. They felt the sting of the lash. And they hated this land." Now, after this historical analysis of slavery and the class divisions in the African-American community that go all the way back in our development, in our people's development in this country, Malcolm observed that a progressive and a revolutionary position on black liberation had to make a choice. Just like there were two traditions in black nationalism, a conservative tradition that said, "Don't get involved in political struggle," where Elijah Muhammad said that if there is police brutality, we should not mobilize against it publicly. Malcolm said there is another alternative. There is an alternative that says, yes, if we are indeed black nationalists, we must struggle to empower our people by any means necessary. So Malcolm said, "I am a field Negro. If I can't live in the house as a human being, I'm praying for that house to blow down, and I'm praying for a strong wind to come along." If the master won't treat me right and he's sick, I'll tell the doctor to go the other way. But if we are all of us going to live as human beings, then I'm for a society in which human beings can practice brother and sisterhood. If one analyzes the late Malcolm X, you see a deepening of a radical and revolutionary vision. He moves away from the blatant sexism of the Nation of Islam in his later development. He recognizes from his experiences in Africa that all progressive nationalist movements have recognized the fundamental equality of women of color. This is what he recognizes. Malcolm says this in December 1964. Quote, "It's noticeable that in the third world societies where they have put women in the closet and discouraged her from getting sufficient education and don't give her the incentive by allowing her maximum participation in whatever area of the society in which she's qualified, they kill her incentive and kill her spirit." Malcolm realized by the end of his life, and again, we've got to understand that that development was cut short by his assassination. But Malcolm begins to recognize at the end of his life that it's not just racism and it's not just corporate capitalism. There are other forms of domination that must be addressed by people who really believe in full democracy and equality, and that means struggling against women's oppression. Malcolm begins to realize this. And finally, there are many sad attempts to minimize the life and legacy of Malcolm, but these will be unsuccessful because Malcolm's influence only grows with time since his assassination. When Malcolm was killed, third world newspapers hailed Malcolm as, quote, the militant and most popular African-American anti-segregationist leader. People began to realize the truth of Malcolm and what he stood for, both politically and also spiritually, to a whole generation of people. Ossie Davis said at Malcolm X's funeral, many of you will ask why Harlem finds to honor this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain. And we will smile. They will say he is one of hate, a fanatic, a racist. And we will answer, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to what he said? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did know him the way we did, you would understand that Malcolm, as Davis put it, was our manhood, our shining black manhood. This was the meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our own shining black prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so. Today, we would only modify Ossie Davis's insight with one modification, that Malcolm was not simply our manhood. He was our humanity, for men and women alike. That Malcolm represented the best within ourselves. He represented the courage and the search for truth and freedom and dignity for African American women and men. That Malcolm was courageous enough to say, yes, I made mistakes. Yes, I was wrong at certain times. And yes, I have learned that the search for truth means many false paths, but the courage of leadership and the price of vision is in admitting those weaknesses, in overcoming them. Malcolm's greatness is found not in placing him as a frozen icon on a mantelpiece. Malcolm's greatness is found in realizing a simple basic truth, that Malcolm is great because we, as African American people, are great. That the greatness in Malcolm is the greatness in ourselves. That when young boys and girls look at Malcolm on a mantelpiece high above them, far beyond reach, they cannot reach or obtain what he achieved. Bring Malcolm down to the people. Honor Malcolm by honoring ourselves, our capacity for struggle, our search for truth and human dignity. Not that Malcolm was right in everything. If Malcolm was here, he'd say, don't freeze me and turn me into a statue. Understand me as a person who struggled for dignity, who fought for freedom, and who tried and died trying to live in a way that could bring honor to ourselves. We need to understand that Malcolm's greatness, that Malcolm's courage, and that his dignity is best served by living his creed, by living his legacy, by challenging the power, by fighting for freedom, by linking up with oppressed people, no matter where they may be, by fighting all systems of domination and exploitation, whatever their names are. In this way, we not only honor the life and legacy of Malcolm X, we honor the best democratic and liberationist traditions in ourselves. Thank you.
That was Manning Marable, By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X. This classic program was recorded at Metro State College in Denver in 1992 and is part of Alternative Radio's celebration of 30 years of independent broadcasting. Manning Marable, a renowned scholar, taught at Columbia University. He was the author of many books, including How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America. His masterwork, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, received the Pulitzer Prize. Manning Marable died in 2011. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Michelle Alexander, Richard Wolff, Naomi Klein, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, Tariq Ali, and Angela Davis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Manning Marable on By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Community who will support you on your academic journey, the Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all three SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
You're listening to CJ.